Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Purdy Insurance. Visit Purdy Insurance on Market Street in Sunbury or visit online at purdyinsurance.com. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Very pleasant good afternoon to you. Sean Carey here. It is the best of Steve Jones Show week on News Radio 1070 WKOK. And the Monday edition, always brought to you by Purdy Insurance on Market Street in Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com. Doesn't matter what type of insurance that you need, life insurance, business insurance, homeowners, auto, rental, they will connect you with the best possible price and the best premium that'll fit your budget. And they're the people that you want in your corner when life happens. Purdy Insurance in Sunbury and at purdyinsurance.com. Sunbury Motors Studio, Sunbury Motors Ford Lincoln Hyundai in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia on the Strip, Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. As we wrap up the month of June here on the Steve Jones Show, we're going to hit the rewind button and replay some of the best interviews we've had on the show, including Pro Football Hall of Famer Jerry Kramer. We'll replay that in the next half hour. We are very football heavy today. That's good. Even though we're now in the first full week of summer, we're always looking forward to football. It's going to lean quite a bit Penn State. Next hour, we'll be chatting. We'll replay Steve's interview from last November with Lee Stout and Harry West about some of the things about Beaver Stadium that you may not be aware of. Also, last September, Steve had a chance to talk with one of the members of the 1982 Penn State National Championship team, Bill Konz. He wrote a book, When the Lions Roared, Joe Paterno and One of College Football's Greatest Teams. Here's Steve's conversation with Bill Konz.
Bill Konz, 82 National Championship team. He wrote a book about it. It's great to see somebody that would be considered an old friend again.
And first off, this has to be one of the most laid-back venues to do a radio show. We're in the alley of the tavern. Yeah. It's just a gorgeous day in State College. It's football weather. Fans are streaming by. I don't know how you get your job done here.
We're trying to somehow focus here.
I get
now.
It.
The two of them over there.
I see them.
Them. Very good. Them.
Anyway, pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here. The of the roots of this, and then it came to fruition. And the roots of this were set up by the early Paterno years, mm-hmm. and then that 78 team that played for the national title. When you came into this, did you sense right away you were entering something special, or at 18 was it just a wide-eyed experience?
It became very apparent. That team that had narrowly lost the Sugar Bowl to Alabama, so close to a national championship, a lot of returning seniors, including Bruce Clark, Matt Millen, guys that went on to have extended pro careers, Matt Sui and Mike Gooman and that crew. And they made it very apparent how upset they were at losing that, and they took it out on us incoming freshmen, Blackledge, Kurt Warner, myself, Mike McCloskey. But you got the sense very early on how good you really needed to be to step on the field at Penn State. There was that caliber of talent up here.
It's an important year here at Penn State. A lot of people don't realize to help set up what happened in 81 and 82 because they were coming off an 8-4 season and one beat Tulane in the Liberty Bowl. Then they go 10-2 in 80. Now it sets up 81, and at one point in 81, Penn State is the number one team in the country. The Miami experience where Warner, I think he pulled a hamstring by the goal line or something like that. It was in a driving rainstorm,
right.
and it did right, and it went 17-14.
You a great point. We are Penn State and Pitt are ranked 1 and 2 at the beginning of the sixth week of the 1981 season.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Kurt Warner injured a hamstring a couple of weeks prior to enabling a guy by the name of John Williams as a true sophomore to run for 140 yards in a big win over West Virginia.
Yeah.
Kurt's banged up. Chet Parlavecchio's banged up. We don't go down there to Miami at 100%. However, we had no idea what we were in for. We went down and played a very poor football game, threw the ball around, fumbled the ball, missed 4 field goals. It's detailed in the book. That's actually where it starts. But, yeah. You know, it's an underrated Miami team with some guys that a lot of Miami players on that defense went on and played professional football, but it knocked us from the ranks of the unbeaten.
And 2 years later, by the way, won the national championship.
Oh, by the way, right.
When they beat Nebraska, when Nebraska went for 2 at the end. But I remember the going to Toffrees right after that game, and Joe would always do his press conference at Toffrees on Tuesdays.
Okay.
And Blackledge had thrown for, I think, 358 or something.
Coming out
like
party
that,
for him.
Right?
Yep, yep.
Huge. And John Williams had 8 catches. Mm-hmm. So they asked him if, he says, you know, he says, you're going to continue to throw the ball like that? And he says, threw for 358, got licked. You know how Joe,
yep,
Joe would say it.
Yep.
And you guys went back to running the football. I mean,
you
got to
realize at the time.
It. You balanced it.
Think about this interior wall. The two guards in the center, Sean Farrell, Jimmy Romano, and Mike Munchak. Two number ones and a number two.
Hall of Famer.
Yeah. Mike, and this is weeks removed from Kurt Warner going out to Lincoln, Nebraska, and setting that stadium's rushing record with 230. Kurt Warner, before he got hurt, had an average per carry that led the Nate to 7 yards a carry. He was unbelievable. But, you know, true to form, Joe, I think, recognizes what his strengths are. And on that team, Todd wasn't quite ready, wasn't consistent enough. I think he admit that. We had the receivers. Kenny Jackson was a freshman, I believe. Garrity a sophomore. We were young. So he went back to basics, if you will. Might have cost us a little bit in the Alabama game, although more mistakes there committed, and Bear Bryant bringing his team up here and just licking us again. So we go into the pit. Yeah,
I remember 8 plays inside the 10-yard line.
How do you think it was?
I remember that. It was yesterday. I think, didn't he try Tommy Barr in an option pass or something like that?
It was so conservative. 7, come away with no points.
Yeah.
You know, and this is Bear Bryant coming up from Harrisburg and so forth and that hold. It was a demoralizing to be ranked number one, and then inside of 3 weeks, you know, we're 10-11. And
what did the 48-14 game do for the confidence of this team, and then to follow it up by basically just taking Marcus Allen to USC apart?
Yeah, you know, the confidence, that group of seniors led by Chet Parlavecchi, our senior co-captain, Leo Wisniewski, Rick D'Amico, Sean Farrell, Munchak, Romano, those guys had an aura about them. And I can't emphasize enough, because that's infectious. These guys projected confidence. They were arrogant. They got in a ton of fights amongst themselves in practice.
There was a swagger.
There was a swagger. Swagger is a great word. And it was well before the Pitt game, 48-14. We go out to Lincoln, Nebraska, and Chet during the week is talking about going out into a hostile territory and playing good football, solid Penn State football, and winning that game. We came back and did that. Now, we had some hiccups along the way, but the 48-14 game, that momentum shift. Now, people don't realize Dan Marino was picking our secondary apart, a secondary that included Mark Robinson, Dan Biondi, Paul Langford, Roger Jackson, right? It's 14-0, and our offense has -1 total yards offense after the first quarter. We're on the sideline thinking, what did we get ourselves into? Here we are playing in Pitt Stadium. They're ranked number one. Their crowd is loving this, right? It's their bitter rival, and they're on the ropes. And, again, for the final three quarters is anything but.
So after winning that game, and then the way Penn State shut down Marcus Allen in the Fiesta Bowl, and won it really with ease. I mean, the only touchdown they scored, I think, was an interception run back for a touchdown.
Absolutely. Yep.
What did that do to the offseason to then set up an 82 season?
The returning seniors, including myself, had high expectations. The mindset at Penn State in the late 70s was 10-win seasons were the norm. We're talking 12-game schedules.
Right.
New Year's Day bowl games were the norm. Playing for the national title. We spoke off-air about, you know, every 4 years a Joe Paterno coach football team was playing for the national title. That was the expectation. That's how you prepared. Yeah. Joe would send off-season letters in the summer. Brian McCann's kind enough to send this to me, and it's documented both in the book and on the website I've constructed about what his expectations were. For 81, he mentions national championships several times in this correspondence. The 82 team, we just got the letter and said, you guys better come back and prepare to work your tails off. So he kind of knew that there was a lot of rebuilding, a lot of new faces in new places. But the confidence was always there. And it certainly helped that guys like Blackledge and Kurt Warner and Garrity stayed on campus during the summer, and they honed that 7-on-7 drill. Garrity was the one, and some of the other guys I interviewed for this book backed it up. They literally had 7-on-7. They organized themselves. I think Todd organized it themselves literally every day. So the timing of the passing game was there from day one at training camp.
And in the first 4 games of the season, they came out and threw the ball. I mean, it was dubbed Air Paterno to open up. It was a shootout with Maryland, 39-31 with Boomer Esiason. And then you get to the Nebraska game.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to sit down and talk about Well, let's really shorten the list. The five greatest games in the history of Beaver Stadium. That is somewhere in your five. It may be one for some. It may be three, but that's one of the five. That was a big week. I remember this. The rumor was going on that Blackledge got hurt in practice.
I hadn't heard that.
Yes. The rumor was that Blackledge got hurt in practice.
I see.
And it used to be. Remember, they were freshmen. Freshman football still happened at that time.
Yeah.
It was over the Flower Garden.
Yep, I remember that.
And everybody saw Blackledge standing there, just standing there. And they went, well, he doesn't have a...
Yeah, well, if he was injured, his shoulder was sore from throwing all the touchdown passes. The first three games, four touchdowns in each of the three wins over Temple, Maryland, and Rutgers, all at home.
Yep.
An aerial display. Kenny Jackson was quoted as saying, it's like night and day around here. And he's exactly right. Now, that didn't bode so well for an offensive line that was... at that point, we had Mark Battaglia starting his third or fourth game ever as a fifth-year senior. We moved Dave Laub and Pete Spiros from tackle to guard. Ron Heller, a former tight end. A lot of inexperience, and it showed early on.
Because Munchak actually could have come back for a year, but Mike decided, you know, he got his degree, and at that time, if you got your degree, you could enter the draft, and Mike did that, so he did not come back for
that. It helps when you go to the, I think, with the Olympia Bowl.
Olympia Gold Bowl in San Diego.
And just flattens everybody he sees and just rockets up the draft chart to be the seventh or eighth player picked in the draft, and the rest speaks for itself. He's an NFL Hall of Famer. I lined up right next to, you know, and that's the other thing. In addition to the arrogance and the confidence, you did not want to play poorly in their presence because they would make it very clear to you what the expectation was. You got better because you witnessed it, as well as saying, look, we expect to run for 300 yards, and then we plan to win this football game. If you're not holding up your end of the rope, we're going to let you know about it.
Well, the game of Nebraska, Penn State was far more dominant than people realize. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were two touchdowns called back on penalties. Mm-hmm. Remember, Garrett? I think Garrity scored both of them. They got called back.
One to Kurt Bowman, one to Garrity. You're right.
And there were four missed field goals.
Yes.
People forget Massimo
Manca. An extra point at the end.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was just going to say. Massimo Manca had like the nightmare of all nightmare days. He missed four field goals. And then on the game, one where everybody's all happy, and he missed the extra point, too.
Right. I mean, on national TV, no less.
You get the final drive.
Mm-hmm.
And this part's from memory. That Nebraska kicked off after Turner Gill scored.
Correct.
And there was they got a 15-yard penalty for unsportsmanlike conduct.
Right.
So you started from the 35.
Yep.
Talk about what's the huddle like?
We're in the huddle, we're on the sideline. And Battaglia pulls the offense together, and it's just a reaffirmation of what we've done all day. And it's like, look, fellas, we have enough time to do this. They haven't stopped us. We're going to get this thing done. Blackledge gets in the huddle, and Ron Heller's quoted book as to how captivated he was at how calm Blackledge was, how he's reinforcing exactly what Mark was saying in a matter-of-fact fashion. Now, in that environment, the fans are going crazy. We got a shot at this, right? We got 65 yards away from Pater. And it was so methodical to see how he ran the offense. He was so sharp, so accurate. Last week with McSorley and Akron, I saw that. It was amazing how he had so many guys in stride.
Yeah.
Todd's doing this under intense pressure.
Yeah.
And it was a thrill to be. First off, we're so tired because at that point we had rung up about 450 yards total offense against a decent Nebraska defense. But it's up and down the field for most of that time. But a thrill to be part of it, and all I remember and what I detail in the book is that the sidelines are lined with people. It seemed like six or seven deep. It was as if the stadium security either were so caught up in it they were watching themselves, or they had gone home early and didn't want to be part of it. A truly phenomenal, phenomenal ending to a game.
The only two catches of Kurt Bowman's career.
Mm-hmm. Both touchdowns.
Both touchdowns in that game. Then Alabama. I mean, you're the better team. You're the better team, and that's the one where Mark Robinson got hurt in the game.
Mm-hmm.
People forget Mike Suter filled in for him, and Mike picked off a pass in the game. It's right there in the book.
Seven tackles.
Yeah,
right.
Had a big game.
Yep.
And he's only remembered for Ralph Giacomero finding his backside.
Isn't that what society does to us? They only... And it's so funny, and I give the book away, but Mike gets off the plane and his brother calls him and he says, ESPN is calling. Now, ESPN is just in its infancy, right? A couple years old.
That's right.
ESPN is calling Mike Suter the loneliest man in college football. Now, you got to know Mike. When he comes back this weekend, he handled it with such class. And it's just people don't realize the guy had never been the personal front protector, minimal snaps in practice.
Because it was Mark.
Right.
Mark was the personal front protector, I think.
I think he was. In fact, that's exactly right. But we go down there high. We just beat Nebraska at home, and we're ready to take on the Bears. Joe's never beaten a guy. It's Legion Field. It's, again, on national television. Yeah. The NFL strike's going on. We're the marquee team again. We're pumped up. We're ready to play, and what do? Just like we did in Miami, we're beating ourselves with turnovers. And that was so frustrating. We're down 21-7 half, and then we start coming back.
Yeah.
And I mentioned to folks in this book, and I hope if you're listening, you pick up a copy of When the Lions Roared. I had a great time putting it together, but I mentioned in the acknowledgments the original title to this was 6 Minutes in Birmingham, because there were 6 minutes or so left on the clock. We've got a 3rd and 1. We're down 27-21 in Alabama territory. Constant McCloskey don't block so well on a sweep. Kurt gets knocked back for a 3-yard loss. We have to punt. If Mike doesn't essentially block our own punt, maybe we pin Alabama back. It's a who, it's a what if, who knows kind of thing. But people look at the final score and say, oh, Alabama blew you out. They may have had a strong first half, but we were fighting back, and we were on the cusp of potentially pulling that thing off.
Joe told me once that after that game, Bear Bryant called him. And, of course, Joe would have to shut the door because, you know how Bear talk. Bear asked him, he says, I think you guys are really, really good. Are we good?
No kidding. I never heard that story.
Yeah, Joe told me that story years ago.
Wow.
And Bear won. He says, are we any good?
Alabama teams are always good. I mean, they kind of fell off that year.
Yeah,
they finished, I think, playing in the Liberty Bowl and
Illinois,
8-4, something like that.
Yep.
But, when you played teams like Alabama, Nebraska, you were arguably playing against players you would see at the next level.
Yeah.
And Rick D'Amico, who was a senior on the 81 team, when I'm talking to him about it, I says, Ricky, did it ever bother you? He says, no. He says, it was just next team up, next man up, next week up.
Yeah.
I mean, Joe had this schedule in such a way that he was going to prove to people whether or not the grand experiment
worked. He scheduled a national championship schedule.
He created his own college football playoff 30 years before it ever existed.
That's a great point, because then you start with Syracuse, and now you start on the comeback trail. I mean, there's a determination on this football team. We're not going to let anything happen from here on out.
It starts with Joe Coles.
Yeah.
In that locker room, we're all sweaty, dog-tired, high humidity, and just beaten down. We're like, how did we come down here and play as poorly as we did? It's 42-1. And he gets up on his stool and delivers as emphatic and impassioned a speech as I've ever been part of. And I've been in locker rooms with Joe Paterno, Sam Ratigliano, Marty Schottenheimer, Jim Mora, Coles' speech. And he'll be on campus this weekend. And I hope people recognize what Joe Coles did to literally inspire his teammates. And we got showered and dressed. And even before that plane landed in Harrisburg, we had a mindset that when we next step on the practice field, it is going to be a work ethic, and we're going to put in extra time. And it started, like you said, with this, where Joe wanted to get back in the running game.
Yep.
And the weather was in. It was a homecoming game.
Yep.
And we had really beaten up Syracuse last year with Farrell and Munchak leading Kurt Warner to break Shorty Miller's rushing record.
That's right.
Remember that in the carry
dome? Yep, 250 up there,
256. So the next year, Syracuse brings guys that are angry. Mike Charles, big defensive lineman, Miami draft him. Tim Green, Atlanta Falcons, undersized, but a really active nose tackle. And a guy named Blaze Winter went to San Diego. This is an NFL caliber front line, and it's a wet day. And these guys, Joe's committed to running the ball. And he says, we got to cut Kurt loose. And he called Kurt into his office that week and says, we're going back to basics here. And the offensive line was the perfect time to do it, because we had just enough experience to get that done. It was a pivotal win for us that year.
And it was because it got everything back on track and reestablished the Penn State identity.
Yeah,
I mean, you got back to your identity. Before Notre Dame, I remember Joe saying, It was the post game, running off the field the game before Notre Dame, and John Grant was the one doing the post game show at the time. And he looks at it, he says, "John, we're in a 3-game playoff for the national championship." They stated it right out.
It shocked some of the players, including myself, because Joe Paterno was never showing his hand early and create bulletin board material. And here he was, that confident in this team, because we had just come off a 52-17 shellacking of Doug Flutie in Boston College up in Chestnut Hill. When that is a very good football team, the best they've had in years, we come home and beat NC State, a team that's always given us problems. That game was 47-0 in the third quarter.
Yep.
Two lopsided victories, right? And when we started reading that, and that was the day that Notre Dame upset number one Pitt in Pitt Stadium,
right?
So all of a sudden the stakes are raised, and of who's doing it is Joe Paterno talking about his own team. Three-game playoff, and if we're good enough to navigate it, we should be playing for the national title.
There's been a long history of teams going into Notre Dame Stadium for the first time, and, of course, along the, that didn't. I remember Joe made a big deal out of it that week. He said, yeah, so what?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Penn State hasn't done it.
His quote in the pregame meal the night before, and this is after the media just really irritated with some kind of questions, apparently. He says, look, Newt Rockne is not going to jump up out of the field and tackle anybody. This is Penn State. We're going to show these people how we play on the road.
Yeah.
We're going to do exactly what we came here to do. We're going to walk out of here with a victory. We're that good. He was, again, another guy. It's funny how you can build confidence simply by having leaders like a Joe Paterno or a Joe Coles really reinforce the message that we're as good as anybody in the country. And at that point in that season, it was something that that we'd all felt was true.
Bill Kontz. When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Subaru Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC way. The choice is up to you. The other guy's way or the SMC way? The SMC way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years.
Here's Adam Purdy with another example of how Purdy Insurance is different.
I was at home one Saturday when I got a call from a client who had just been in an auto accident with a rental car in Canada. After confirming that everyone was okay, I checked his policy and assured him that we had the proper coverages in place. Within a few minutes, I had his claim called in and he was back to enjoying his vacation.
Purdy Insurance has been answering calls like this for over 90 years.
Give Purdy Insurance a call today at 800-677-2478 to see what we can do for you.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
And Sean Carey here for Steve this week. The best of the Steve Jones Show on WKOK. If you miss any of our shows live on WKOK, we invite you to subscribe to our Steve Jones Show podcast, available on both iTunes, Google Play, the Apple Podcast app. Search Steve Jones Show. And, of course, our website, stevejonesshow.com. We've got 3 months of shows always there on the podcast archive page. Monday edition of our Steve Jones Show, always brought to you by Purdy Insurance on Market Street in Sunbury. Go to purdyinsurance.com. Servicing the Valley for decades, insurance products that are reputable, the ones you know and trust, and they can customize a plan to fit your needs and your budget. Go to purdyinsurance.com. Better yet, stop by and see them on Market Street in Sunbury. Well, the Phillies took 2 out of 3 over the weekend. Really should have got the sweep over Washington, but blew the lead last night, lost 8-6. That was the Phillies' first primetime game on ESPN in 5 years. And tonight, they go to interleague play, cranking up a 3-game set with the New York Yankees from Citizens Bank Park. We'll have live coverage tonight here on WKOK, beginning at 6:30 with On Deck, first pitch at 7:05. So it'll be 7:05 games coming up tonight, tomorrow, and Wednesday. Back in February, a couple of days before the Super Bowl, and it was the day before, we found out that this guy, who waited over a half a century to get into the Pro Football Hall of Fame, finally made it in. Jerry Kramer. Jerry Kramer making it into the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and we had a golden opportunity to have a chance to speak with him back in February.
There's so many wonderful moments and memories and things. The biggest thing he did, of course, was give me a severe chewing and then tell me I was going to be one of the best guards in football and that I could be, and encouraged me that he believed in me and approved. And so I started working overtime and all the time and every time and trying to become perfect, and changed my life. It's really a wonderful thing. I wasn't aware of approval being that powerful. I had no idea that belief would make that kind of difference, but it certainly made a difference in my life. And I think in virtually every guy on our team, one way or another, Coach Lombardi practiced his psychology on him. And I know that Herb Adderley was telling us a while back that he came off the field one day and Coach Lombardi ran up to him and said, "Herb, you have just played the finest game I ever saw a cornerback play. The best ever. Take that with you from now on." Herbie said for the rest of his career, whenever he got on the field, he wanted to play the best game a cornerback had ever played. So that's the kind of and we trained and we did the plays, and we weren't very tricky with our plays. Everybody knew. Coach Hallis had the great comment. He said, "We knew what they were going to do. We knew where they were going to do it, and we knew when they were going to do it. We just couldn't do anything about it." So we practiced and practiced and practiced, and then with the determination and the will and the fire and the burn, we executed. So that's part of the puzzle. I had no history of Lambeau when I arrived there, but I'll tell you what my last game was like. I really didn't understand the fans, and I was hanging out with the guys and doing most of the stuff with the guys, and I'd sign a few autographs, but I really, and when I'm playing on the field, I see the guy across from me. I don't even see the sidelines. I don't see anybody on the edge of the field or in the stands or anywhere else, and very little awareness, and except after a play, you hear some applause maybe when you come off the field or run back on it or come out at halftime, you hear things, but generally there's just not a lot of penetration there. And we're playing Baltimore, the last game of the season, and Coach Lombardi is the general manager. And we're a so-so season, but we have to win this last game to have a chance. And there's got to be a plane wreck and a train wreck and a whole bunch of other things to happen for us to get in the playoffs. But we're gonna win, and we're gonna get in the playoffs. And we get the ball with 3-4 minutes to go, and we start marching down the field, just bing bang, tearing up pieces of dirt and moving down the field, and looking like we always did and knew we were going to win, and we fumbled. And they recovered. And you look up at the clock, and there's about a minute and 40 seconds left to go. And you go, "Oh, it's over. It's over." I start off the field kind of slow, and then I kind of trot, and I hear this applause coming from the stands. And I go, "It's over. It's all over. We're going to lose. We're not going to be in the playoffs." And the applause grows and grows and grows. And when I get to the sidelines, the whole stadium is standing up applauding. And I go, "What in the... Oh. Oh. They know. They knew what I knew. They knew the moment I knew that it was over. And they're saying thank you for yesterday, for all the years, for all the victories, for all the effort. Wow. I didn't know fans were that sophisticated. I didn't know that they really followed the game that closely." So I got a whole new awareness and appreciation for the fans at that time. And I've been trying to pay them back for 50 years, and I haven't gotten close. They are just sensational. They're true sportsmen, more so than just football fans. The opponent comes to town, and there's no hassle. If an opponent jersey comes into a place where the people are hanging out, they're Packers, it's, "Hey, I hope you have a nice trip. I hope you enjoy the game." It's civil. And it's just wonderful. So I can go on about the Packer fans for the rest of the year, but never get it done properly.
Jerry, Steve Jones, pleasure to have you with us. A privilege, as a matter of fact.
Penn State played Maryland, and Jack Ham and I, my broadcast partner and I, were driving back. We were talking about Andy Russell. And I said, he should be in the Hall of Fame. And Jack, of course, he said he learned more about playing linebacker from him in the pro level than anybody. And then we both said, you know what? Jerry Kramer should be in the Hall of Fame. So you got a lot of people out there that want you there, just like obviously you want to be there. When you look over the years, you've written several books. What did it take for you to write those books? How difficult was it along the way? And because of experience, did the last couple become easier?
Yes. To answer your last question first, it definitely made a difference once you'd had some success. The doubt and the uncertainty and the brand new world was kind of daunting for a while. And I, you know, we're big football players, and big football players are supposed to be stupid. And most people think they are, as I think, a defense mechanism primarily because they're smaller and they're not physically superior, so they have to be mentally superior to be superior. So they give you a lot of grief about it. But Dick called me one day and said, you want to do a book? What do you mean, do a book? Write a book. I said, Dick, what do I know about writing a book? He says, I'll tell you what we'll do. Y'all get a tape recorder. You'll record your actions, your thoughts, your reflections, your schedule, your teammates, everything about it, and I'll transcribe it into words, and we'll make a book out of it. And I said, who gets final say? He said, you do. I said, let's talk. So we went to New York and talked with the publisher, and there was probably 8 or 10 people in the room, Dick and I and the agent and publisher and several other folks. And so I asked the publisher, I said, what is good for a book? What do we have to do good? Because I want to do good. I don't know what it is, but I want to do it. And he said, Jerry, sports books traditionally don't sell. They have been difficult, and if we do 7,500 to 10,000 books, we'll do good. We'll do real good. I said, okay, I got a target now. So I was able to do, went back to Green Bay and started thinking about the book, and then I decided I had to be very flowery with my language and use big, long words and be very, very wordy. And that lasted about 3 days, and my little sub says, hey, fat boy, it is what it is, and you is what you is. Now just tell it like you believe it to be, and you see it, and be dead honest with it, and you won't have to answer any questions about it. So I changed my strategy a little bit and tried to be as dead honest as I could be. And got to meet some really interesting people like Flip Wilson and Jackie Suzanne and Norman Mailer and Gore Vidal and Tiny Tim and on and on and on. And the book sold 440,000 copies the first year.
Yeah.
We're on the bestseller list for 44 weeks. And so, yes, it was much easier to do the second book after that kind of a reception.
Speaking of books, there was one point where Joe Paterno looked at me and he said, are you reading any books lately? Because he said he was reading something about Winston Churchill. And I said to him, well, I just finished reading When Pride Mattered. And Joe said, hey, you know, I'm in that book, which showed the pride he felt in having any relationship with Vince Lombardi. He said Lombardi, when he was around him before a preseason game, was really nervous. And I guess that's the way Lombardi was all the time. In particular, with Super Bowl I, with not just carrying the weight of the Green Bay Packers, but the NFL, did you sense that even more so?
You know, there was certainly a tension in the room and in the meetings and everything, and the fines were escalated from $500 to $5,000 for sneaking out or missing curfew or those kind of things. So that was the obvious impact, and so everybody knew he was serious. But you didn't know about nerves, right? And when I found out really how nervous Coach Lombardi was prior to Super Bowl I was from Frank Gifford. Giff and I were talking a year later, and he said, Jerry, I knew there were two networks broadcasting the game, so I'm trying to be cool. I put my hand on Coach Lombardi's shoulder, and he's shaking like a leaf. He's just shaking. Yeah. And I go, wow. And he, because Coach Lombardi was so nervous, then I got nervous, and I started worrying about things. But, yeah, he had a lot of pressure on him. Some of the other owners had called him and asked him to embarrass the AFL. There was some animosity there in the early stages. And so he felt like he had a great burden on his back, and he was not only representing the Green Bay Packers, he was representing the whole National Football League. So I think he was quite nervous.
You actually were the 39th overall pick in the draft, which meant you were like a third or fourth round pick then. This year, that this time you'd be a second round pick. But the first year with the Packers, you only won a game. And then he comes in and he takes over. Eventually he made a statement, I don't know if it was to you or to somebody else, Jerry Kramer doesn't know how good he really is. When that got back to you in one form or another, what did that do for the confidence in your career and in your life?
Coach Lombardi said that, actually, and it wasn't to me, it was maybe to a writer or someone, but he took me aside. He gave me a severe chewing. I had scrimmaged goal line, 100 degrees, 98% humidity, physical error. I missed a block, and four plays later, I jump off sides. And a physical block is one thing, and a mental block or a mental error is just unacceptable. We have some control over that, so we shouldn't do that. So he comes running across the field and gets about 10 inches from my nose, and he goes, Mister, the concentration period of a college student is 5 minutes, high school is 3 minutes, kindergarten is 30 seconds, and you don't have that, so where's that put you? Oh, it put me checking my shoe shine. And things ended 15 minutes later. Scrimmage ended and went up to the locker room and went down to the end of the locker room to my locker and shucked my shoulder pads, helmet off, put my chin on my hand, my elbow on my knee, and I'm checking the design of the carpet for about 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And wondering what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. Never going to be able to play for this guy, and it's time to get out of this, and I'm going to another team, or maybe I'm time to get out of football. You know, it's a lot of guys are leaving early. The salary wasn't sensational at that time, and so I'm sitting there contemplating my future, and he walks in, comes down the room to my locker, messes up my hair, pats me on the head. Son, one of these days you're going to be the best guard in football. And he let me know that he approved of me, that he believed in me, and he wasn't a man that dealt in idle chatter. He was a pretty serious human being, and so if he believed in me, then I could believe in me, and it changed my life. And virtually everything in it. I developed a totally different philosophy and attitude, and I tried to play the perfect game. Never quite got there, but got close. But from that point on, and that has stayed with me after football. I kept a picture up of him up on my wall above my desk at my office at home, and that picture was taken by a photographer who encroached on Coach Lombardi's territory, and Coach turned around and looked at him, and he was clearly out of position. He was way too close, and Coach gave him the ugliest look you could ever imagine, and certainly the worst one he could bring up. And the guy shot the photo. Oh, I love the photo. I just had seen him angry a number of times, so I got me a big blow-up of it and put it over my desk. And every time I said, I'll get it done, I'm going to make the call, I'll take care of that, I'd look up there and see him, and then I'd make the call, or I'd do my chores, or I'd do whatever I was supposed to do. And we always know we should do something, but coulda, woulda, shoulda, wish I had a gun a butt.
Yeah.
Always comes along too, so he kept me going for a long time.
two last things. One of them will deal with Cologuard and cancer, of course, but the other one's going to deal with, just very quickly, when you broke the huddle in the Ice Bowl, did you think Chuck Mercine was getting the ball?
No, for some reason, after that play,
was gonna
I turned
sneak
around.
It?
I'm sorry?
I said, you thought Bart was going to sneak it, really?
After the play was over, I turned around and looked for Bart. I turned back to my right and looked for Bart. I didn't look for Chuck. Chuck thinks everybody heard it. Maybe Bart said on the way up to the line of scrimmage, Jerry, I'm going to keep the ball. But I don't know for sure, but I felt that Bart was going to keep the ball. It seemed like it. That was something I knew, and so I looked for him. I didn't look for Chuck.
Okay.
So I had suggested that play and on Thursday, short yardage films. Jethro was high. He made a mistake that he'd made 3 weeks before, and the three games before that game, he was up high. So I mentioned to Coach Lombardi that we could run the wedge if we had to, and he goes, what? I said, we can run a wedge if we have to on you. No, we'll run it back. That's right, put in a wedge. So
wow.
You didn't deal with him with idle chatter, you know. You didn't make chit-chat. Mm-hmm. You better had something to say and something that was important if you're going to bother him. So, yeah, I felt that... I still feel that way, and I've talked to Chuck about it recently. In fact, Chuck was at lunch today, and we were together a month ago in Green Bay for the Ice Bowl evening and spent several days together. And his memory is that everybody heard it. My memory is I was looking for Bart.
Yeah.
So I guess it'll go down that way. And also, I was not offsides. I was I had a great start, and I came off the ball extremely well, and I made the block. So,
end of story.
You know
what? I never once thought that. I thought you just shot off the ball and just got him. I mean, seriously, I really did. Finally, cancer and Cologuard. How important is for all of us to make sure, especially men, that we are on track with that?
Well, you really don't need to take these tests if you don't want to live. But if you're interested in living, then it's really a good idea. This is a medical advancement that does a DNA on your excretions, and you can do this in the privacy of your bathroom or your bedroom. It's non-invasive. It's just put it in a little package and send it in, and the doc analyze the DNA. And if you have cancer cells in your stool, then you need to call the doc and go see him. If not, you're fine. But we lose 50,000 people a year to colon cancer. And if you want to know more about it, our website is colonguardtest.com, and it is the bright thing to do, and it's the right thing to do.